9. And is here for oral argument today. Both parties here, as you know, are given 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish. Please identify yourselves for the record as you begin your arguments. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Sharon Jacks, and I'm the Assistant State Public Defender representing the appellants in this matter and their challenges to their unconstitutional test refusal convictions. The district court,
Could I ask just one clarification just so that I'm understanding for sure? Is it true, Ms. Jacks, that these precise issues have been previously argued to a separate panel of this court?
Well, I would say that no, they have not, Your Honor. I do know that in two different cases that the issue came up at oral argument or in the reply briefs in the cases. I will say that to my knowledge, no one has completely briefed the issue. So I think this is the only case where both parties have briefed the issue in full. Is timeliness a factor in two other cases? I believe yet that yes, it is.
All right. Thank you for that clarification.
Sure. The district court here erred in determining that the petitioners or the appellants here's petitions were untimely because they were all filed within 2 years of the Supreme Court decision in Johnson, which reversed this court and made the Birchfield rule retroactively applicable to their cases. The post-conviction statute required them to file their petitions within 2 years of when they should have known they had a claim that they could establish Birchfield was retroactive. And a reasonable person wouldn't have known before Johnson that they could have done that. That's because on the face of Birchfield, there's nothing indicating that it is or will be applicable retroactively. In fact, one of the three decisions making up the Birchfield rule in State versus Thompson, the Minnesota Supreme Court declined to address the retroactivity issue. This issue was raised in multiple counties throughout the state and at this court for 22 months, and every judge who considered the issue, save one lone dissenter, determined that Birchfield, in fact, was not retroactive. It was in Fagan where the Minnesota Supreme Court expressly stated that it was Johnson that made the rule retroactive. The legislature's word choices and the rules of grammar support this reading of the statute. The legislature created two independent conditions that a petitioner was required to meet. Had the legislature deemed the announcement of a new rule as also the establishment of retroactivity, it wouldn't have worded the statute in this way. There may be cases where that date is one and the same because the decision that announces the rule also states that it's retroactively applicable. Or perhaps it's a decision that is substantive, announces a substantive rule on its face, and it's clear to anyone reading it that, in fact, it will retroactively apply. But that is not the case with the Birchfield rule. In State versus Chambers, the Minnesota Supreme Court addressed the timeliness of a petition under this particular exception, and the court analyzed each of these two elements, if you will, of the exception independently. And while we recognize that there's some language in the Jackson cases that are not helpful to our position, there certainly was no holding in either of the Jackson cases that every time a new rule is announced, that the 4B3 exception has begun to run. There, all the court did was hold that the pro se petitioners in those cases had not alleged enough in order to meet the exception. And in those cases, unlike this case, the petitioners did not allege any facts or law to establish the retroactive application of the rule or the case that they were relying on. Finally, the legislative intent supports appellant's reading of this statute. It's been settled that the statute of limitations of the post-conviction statute is supposed to be construed with equitable principles in mind. And fairness is not served, or justice is not served, by allowing more unconstitutional convictions to stand. It's probably one of the reasons why there's really, to my knowledge, only two counties in the entire state that is even raising this timeliness issue. There is an effort to ensure that unconstitutional convictions are vacated. There's no issue here, as the state alleges, with finality concerns, because the time has now run. 2 years from Johnson has already passed, and there never was any floodgates with these cases. So to my knowledge, the state public defender's office filed at most 40 petitions on these cases throughout the state of Minnesota.
Can I ask you this? If we adopt your interpretation of the statute, and we and we find a rule that you are correct, that it begins once the appellate court has made a decision that it's retroactive, doesn't that create some uncertainty in the law? Because I mean, then it's going to be totally dependent on when the state gets around to deciding the issue. And that could be, you know, 2 years after the new interpretation of the law case has been decided, or it could be 10 years. I mean, should that be considered in our analysis of this?
Well, I think as a practical matter, that's not going to happen, because anytime a new rule is announced, there's always going to be a trailblazer like Mr. Johnson, who is going to file an attempt, give it a shot, try to establish that the rule applies to them. So I've never seen.
But wouldn't there be more stability in the law? Wouldn't there be more stability in the law if it involves an interpretation of law? A new interpretation of a substantial right, that everyone at that point is put on notice that the statute that the new interpretation may give rise to a retroactive effect.
Yeah, and our construction, Judge Hooten, would not hamper that in any way. We would acknowledge that there will be cases where, on their face, maybe the recent stalking cases, AJB and Peterson, perhaps those are cases where it's so obvious on the face of the opinion that the court has announced a substantive rule that has narrowed the class of people who can be held criminally liable, and a reasonable person should have known in those cases that they retroactively apply to them from the date of the issuance of the opinion. That simply isn't the case in Johnson. Johnson relied, or the Birch rule relies on the Fourth Amendment, which almost always indicates the announcement of a procedural rule. That is in fact what every district court and every appellate judge, you know, held in Minnesota for a 22-month period before finally in State versus Johnson, the Minnesota Supreme Court said no, after extensive analysis, that in fact, it was in fact a substantive rule that was retroactive. This case is very different than the type of factual scenario you're describing.
So how do we, I guess, so is there a different rule if it's really obvious versus when it's not obvious? Is that what you're
Well, the rule is, yeah, I think the rule of law is the same.
I mean, because it should have known. Yeah.
Yeah, the rule of law is the same. It's always when should a reasonable person have known? And as applied to different fact patterns, to different fact scenarios, that, as I said, in some cases, the date of the pronouncement of the rule may in fact also be the date that a reasonable person should have known it was retroactive. That simply can't be said in this situation, given the complexity of the Birchfield rule and its analysis.
Are you aware of any situation anywhere in any case law that's dealt with this precise issue where there's been a substantial change or a change in the law involving a substantial right, where the triggering of the statute of limitation begins at the point where the appellate court has actually made a determination of retroactivity?
I would tell you that we raised 4B3 in all the Haywood cases, and those were almost all filed within the 2 years of Haywood, because on its face, it you know, presumably changed the law. But even in that case, beyond the 2 years, for instance, there were a couple of straggler cases in Ramsey County. They didn't even, you know, make a timeliness challenge. I mean, the state can always, as the Supreme Court recognized in Carlton, can always waive or forfeit their timeliness challenge and just go straight to the merits. And as officers of the court, I think a lot of county attorneys, when they see these cases where individuals are sitting with unconstitutional convictions, they choose to do that. The one other point I'd make is that the state's interpretation of the statute really encourages multiple people to file repetitive petitions and appeals on the same issue, which really is not in the interests of judicial economy. Usually when there's these new changes in the law, the better course for the public lawyers involved as well as the courts is, you know, to let there be to let there be a couple of cases that percolate through, and then and if we lose, then there's not a filing of multiple petitions throughout the state and frivolous appeals. If someone like Mr. Johnson wins, well, then it gives an opportunity.
I mean, I guess the solution to that question is, you know, people could file all those appeals, and then there could be some, you know, joint order to stay pending, you know, the decision. So, I mean, I understand your point in judicial economy, but I think there is a solution to that.
Yeah, at least at the Court of Appeals, there may be, in the district court, not so much. And I will tell you that we've had very different responses from the Court of Appeals on our motions to stay during, you know, the Bernard cases and these cases. Sometimes they're stayed, sometimes
they're
not.
Well, I didn't say it was a great strategy. I just said
I will tell you, it's a sometimes losing strategy. But in the end, I think you have to come back to the statutory language, and the courts is not in a position where it can rewrite the statute. The legislature used the term "and," both of those conditions therefore must be met. And because these appellants did allege that the Johnson decision made Birchfield retroactively applicable to them, we'd ask that you reverse and vacate their convictions.
All right, thank you, Ms. Jacks. Mr. Kennedy.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Well, Mr. Kennedy, I don't want to steal your thunder, but I thought I would just give you a heads up. Speaking for myself and not the panel, I believe Ms. Jacks is correct. Why is she wrong?
May it please the court, my name is George Kennedy. I appear on behalf of the state of Minnesota. Your Honor, it helps if I explain this through one of the specific cases here, and that's Mr. Sheehy's case. He was convicted on December 21st, 2015. The Birchfield rule was complete with Trahan and Thompson on October 12th, 2016. His conviction was still within the general 2-year time frame under 4A. So he did not need a retroactivity determination to file a post-conviction petition using that new rule. He had 1 year, 2 months, and 9 days to file that petition. Subdivision 4B3 only applies if a claim is ripe. So that means that you can't raise a claim under that provision until all the requirements are met. So if the appellants are correct, he could have brought his post-conviction claim until that 2-year time frame expired on December 21st, 2017, and then he no longer would have had a post-conviction claim. He would have needed to wait until Johnson came out in August 22nd, 2018, and then he would have time under this provision.
Well, you know, so I know we're all in appellate land where all things like that can happen, but as a matter of sort of, you know, I mean, do you actually think that's how it would have worked? I think that's impractical. And I mean, I just, you know, I understand your argument, but, you know, in the real world, do you really think that's how that was what would have happened?
I think in the real world, what's supposed to have happened is what Johnson, Strom, and Ulrich did, where they filed the petitions and they litigated them all the way through. None of them had the benefit when they were filing their petitions of saying, okay, I have a decision that is exactly on point on retroactivity, but they still felt like they had the facts and they had a legal argument that it was a retroact, that the Birchfield rule was a retroactive decision. And based on that, that shows that the claim arose under 4B3 when the new rule was announced in Trahan and Thompson. So if we're going to say that a claim arises, that shows it's when the new rule is announced and not when there is a appellate court decision recognizing its retroactive effect. The appellant's construction requires changing the statute to add language after the and, so it says, and the petitioner establishes that according to the United States Supreme Court or Minnesota appellate court, this interpretation is retroactively applicable to the petitioner's case. That creates another problem.
Well, can I?
Yes, Your Honor.
How do you respond though to the appellant's argument that in this case, how would a reasonable person know or should have known that it would be retroactive when you have basically probably a majority of the district court judges as well as the appellate court finding it was not retroactive? I assume it's a reasonable layperson standard. Why would that constitute a should have known situation under these circumstances?
Well, I think that the procedural posture in the history of Johnson, Strom, and Ulrich shows that it was ongoing litigation. As the appellants pointed to in the reply brief on Ramos v. Louisiana, we want these cases to be brought early so that there is vigorous litigation through the district and appellate courts to figure out this issue because it is complicated. But that doesn't change the date when the claim arises. It's still a question of when that new interpretation is announced. There weren't any factual changes to these petitions. There weren't new facts that got added to their claim. There was an appellate court decision that agreed with the argument that they had before the state Supreme Court decided Johnson. They just didn't bring it within the 2-year time frame. So the other issue that this creates, because a claim can't be brought under 4B3 unless it is ripe. If the appellants are correct that you need to have an appellate court decision on retroactivity, then we have a scenario where obviously substantive rules, like the decision in Haywood, do not get litigated into the appellate courts. So there isn't ever an appellate court decision on retroactivity for that rule or for that interpretation, which means that those petitioners' claims are not, they haven't arisen, so they can't properly come before the court, and the state would be within its right to object based on timeliness. I'm not saying that on obviously substantive rules that's appropriate. I don't think that assistant county attorneys or county attorney offices throughout the state of Minnesota would do that. But it creates, their argument creates a gap in the law where the state would essentially have to waive the statute of limitations on every single case. I don't think that that's what the legislature had in mind, because it is forcing that uncertainty into the time frame to bring a claim. During appellant's argument, she said that usually these are dealt with through a trailblazing case. Right now, the retroactivity of McNeely rule is pending before the state Supreme Court. That's 7 years after McNeely was decided that we're getting to the point of addressing retroactivity for McNeely with test refusal cases. I don't see how that squares with finality of decisions, because instead of getting these wrapped up quickly after that 2013 decision, instead of litigating it all the way through and forcing the issue through multiple petitions, we're now coming back to it 7 years after the fact. If we're going to have hearings on these issues, the officers that are involved are going to be 7 years more removed from when they were involved in the case. The purpose of having a statute of limitations is, in these sorts of cases, is finality. We want to bring these in sooner rather than later. It's designed to create a race to the courthouse so that we have fewer issues with witnesses being available or remembering what happened, which all supports our interpretation of the statute.
You know, statutes of limitations are not unconstitutional. The issue here is, you know, something was declared unconstitutional, and now we have to determine, and now it's been determined it's retroactive, and it's like, where does this fit along the spectrum? So while I have some sympathy with the fact that, yes, you know, as time goes by, you know, it's always better for the defense than the prosecution, but, I think that's neither here nor there. The question now is, you know, under this set of facts and the statute, as Judge Hooten sort of pointed out, well, you know, what would the reasonable person would have done? So I did find your argument relating to McNeely interesting. I suppose it's possible the Supreme Court could say, well, you know what, it's not retroactive. So, you know, that's the end of that. And I don't know what they're gonna do. But what's the argument in response to Mrs. Jacks that said, which is, first of all, it always seems, I don't know if 40 cases is a flood or not. You know, it's certainly maybe less than all, you know, I remember, I'm old enough to remember all the intoxilizer cases, and, you know, that went on forever. But you know, what's the best argument to say, you know what, a reasonable person would have acted sooner? What is your best argument for that?
If someone, the Birchfield decision completed in Trahan and Thompson touched on everything that was involved in test refusal cases. So the statute is set up so that you have to assert a new interpretation. You need to affirm or state that a new interpretation exists. And then separately, you need to establish or prove that it's retroactive. So it's an issue of saying, aha, there is a new interpretation of statutory or constitutional law. And then asking the separate question, can I prove that this applies to me? And we have multiple cases. We have Johnson and Strom and Ulrich, where the petitioners looked at these and said, there's a new rule, and I think this gives a benefit to me. Therefore, I should be able to file a petition. And they went through the process of filing the petitions, litigating it before the district court, litigating it before this court. And Johnson ultimately ended up before the state Supreme Court. If the appellants are correct, Johnson should have ended up with two separate outcomes. On his later conviction, that should have been immediately remanded to the district court for the adversarial hearing. The other Johnson case, I believe, is 2010 conviction. And then Strom and Ulrich, because they all required a 4B3 petition, should have been dismissed with an instruction to refile under, now that there was a rule for them to rely on. So really, Johnson 1 should have only dealt with that 2014 or 2015 conviction. And the other ones weren't properly before the court if the appellants are correct. So if we want to talk about judicial economy, getting these cases filed within 2 years of the new rule so that we have fewer issues with witnesses, we can get a more accurate outcome through testimony, and ultimately we have more cases arguing these issues so that through all of the litigation, we come to the correct outcome. I think that promotes judicial economy more than picking two or three cases to file, hoping that you're successful with those, and then waiting until later on to file the remaining cases. I'd also point out that if I've read Johnson, Strom, and Ulrich correctly, all three of those only raised the retroactivity exception or the retroactivity rule for substantive interpretations. None of those claimed that the Birchfield rule was a sea change in procedural law. So there was a separate basis to argue retroactivity that existed throughout this entire process. It would have been a tougher battle for the appellants or for the petitioners. And that's what Ramos was talking about when they discussed it's a high burden. But the Johnson decision, the Johnson, Ulrich, and Strom decisions did not completely prohibit petitioners from filing post-conviction petitions under 4B3. They could have raised it and argued, made the same arguments. They could have also argued that it was a change in the law that was so significant it required retroactive effect. So based on all of this, the reasonable interpretation is that the petition needs to be filed within 2 years of when the new rule can be claimed. And then there is a separate burden to prove the rule's retroactive effect. And because of that, the district court did not err. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Kennedy. Ms. Jacks, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I think my main point is just that Mr. Kennedy doesn't discuss at all the statutory language, and ultimately this court is bound by that. And what the statute says is that the petitioner has to assert a case that establishes a new law, and then the petitioner has to establish retroactivity. If they had meant assert retroactivity, the legislature would have said that. I understand the state's concern that sometimes these cases take a long time, and issues with finality may arise. But in addition to the fact that there is a final end date under our interpretation of the statute, and that is 2 years from Johnson, it simply isn't an issue here. And furthermore, the court has to remember that finality is one of the main considerations for the court that is tasked with determining whether or not a rule is retroactive. And so, you know, here the Supreme Court in Johnson determined that finality was outweighed by the other policies, and that the opinion is retroactive because these unconstitutional convictions shouldn't stand, that people who didn't commit any conduct or engage in any conduct that wasn't unlawful shouldn't have a conviction for that. So I think the finality consideration was taken was dealt with in Johnson itself. And so we would simply ask that you reverse the district court here and vacate these four appellants' convictions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate your arguments and your briefing on the matter. We'll take the matters under advisement at this time, and we will issue a decision on the matter within 90 days. We stand adjourned at this time. Judge Connolly.